All right, good morning. Welcome to session 322. Session's titled Conversation with Author and Critic William Bickerton, Forgotten Latter-day Prophet, but William Bickerton is not the author or the critic. We'll be excited to hear in a moment from John Hamer and from Daniel Stone about this fantastic new book. Before we begin, we have a few announcements. These are the announcements you've been hearing all weekend, for the most part. We ask that cell phones are turned off, that those attending are respectful and attentive. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. If you haven't already, consider subscribing to Sunstone and the magazine, the podcast, all the things at the registration desk as well. We also have a kind of a fun announcement. During lunch today from 12:30 to 2, signature book authors will be signing copies of their books, all of which are available from Benchmark Books. Tables are set up near the Benchmark Books concourse. So we'll authors that will be there, Gary Bergera, in his book, Confessions of a Mormon Historian, The Diaries of Leonard J. Arrington, Stephen Carter, Moth and Rust, Mormon Encounters with Death, Deha Early, to the Mormon newlyweds who taught the belly button was somehow involved, Dima Quinn, who I noticed in the audience today, The Mormon Hierarchy, Wealth, and Corporate Power, and our own Daniel Stone about this book here, William Bickerton. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask that both audience and presenters keep within that framework of time so that we can allow the next session to start on time. As you can see in your program, the presentation description is as follows. Join John Hamer, critic, and Daniel Stone, author, for an in-depth conversation about the new book, William Bickerton, Forgotten Latter-day Prophet. That's out on Signature Books. This is the previously untold biography of William Bickerton, founder of the third largest Latter-day Saint denomination known as the Church of Jesus Christ, from his origins in the early Mormon movement to his role as leader of his own denomination. Bickerton's life mirrors America's broader religious history with an emphasis on free will, individualism, and determination to know God on a personal level. John C. Hamer is an historian and a mapmaker. His research focuses primarily on the history of the Latter-day Saint movement. He is a leading expert on various schisms of Mormonism. He serves as a 70 in the Community of Christ and helps pastor its Toronto congregation. Daniel P. Stone, I failed to mention my name, John Stone, but there's no relation. We tried. It was very Mormon of us. Daniel P. Stone is a PhD candidate studying American religious history at Manchester Metropolitan University in the United Kingdom. He earned an MA and a BA in history and has taught at Florida Atlantic University and the University of Detroit Mercy. He is also a deacon in the Church of Jesus Christ. We'll go ahead and turn the time over to these two great folks.
Thanks, John. I'm very, 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 very excited to be here. I have to make two corrections to the bio as read. First, it says that I'm the leading scholar on all of the verse paths of the Restoration, and I want to say that the leading scholar on that is here at the conference, Steve Shields, and he's not here in the audience here, but he's around. And the exciting news about Steve's work is that his Divergent Paths of the Restoration has been reworked into an entirely new edition, and it's about, right now anyway, 1,000 pages long, but hopefully through editing we'll get to be where you can actually hold it in your hands. And that's already with Coford Books, and it's being edited. And so we've been looking forward to that for over a decade, but anyway, it's hopefully we only maybe a year or so away, and so we're very, very excited about that. And the other correction is that I've been characterized here as a critic of this book, and I just can't even be critical at all. So I am so excited about this book. And so this is an author has met his booster, and so we'll talk a little bit about it. And so I want to just begin with just a little bit of a background for those of you who maybe aren't as aware about the Church of Jesus Christ, the third largest denomination within the Latter-day Saint movement, so people are quite aware of the largest denomination within this movement. It's very well known. And some of you, you know, are, you know, a little bit aware of the second largest denomination within it, so the former Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints Community of Christ, of which I'm a member. But the Church of Jesus Christ, sometimes called with headquarters in Monongahela, Pennsylvania, sometimes we put parentheses and we say Bickertonite in honor here of William Bickerton, is a little bit less well-known. And one of the reasons why it's a little less well-known to all of us is, in the rest of the movement, is that whereas a whole bunch of the these expressions of the movement are out here in Utah, sort of, you know, let's say, encamped or in the shadow of the big Mormon church. And so we've met so many members of here at Sunstone. It's so wonderful to see from the different fundamentalist Mormon groups and reforms from within thereof and independence and everything that have been here and welcomed in Sunstone. And then the other groups are, in some cases, they've gathered back to Jackson County, Missouri. They've gathered back to the New Jerusalem, the Garden of Eden, and all that sort of thing. And so they're in that way kind of in the shadow of the big Nautilus spiral temple that we have there, you know, in that case. And so in those cases, we are very aware then of those two groups. These guys, you know, I couldn't really care the less about what the rest of us have been doing all this time. They have been there. You know, the one and only true church, and they're the little rock that has been carved without hands, and it is rolling forth to fill up the world. And what we're all doing, they don't care, you know, and they're off in Pennsylvania on their own, and they've been doing, anyway, you know, their own thing very interestingly all the way back to 1844 on a different path than we've all been on. And so we'll talk a little bit about it just to give you guys some context. And then Daniel's going to come up and talk a little bit about Bickerton and the book and some of the surprising things. Then we'll have a conversation. I'll ask him a couple questions and we'll invite you guys to ask him questions. So just for context, I do these kind of things. Put my book down. Because I talk with my hands, and it's dangerous with a book in my hands. So I do this kind of thing, and while you guys are pretty aware, especially if you've been having your hair braided, that there's more than one kind of Mormon, you know. And of course, we're pretty aware of Mitt Romney and his kind of Mormon. You maybe have been much more aware of people like Cody Brown on reality TV. There's been a big splash in that kind of Mormon, and also Betty Jessup here. Maybe you're less familiar with Alice Cooper as a type of Mormon. And so, you know, into these different kind of categories as we maybe talk about it. So obviously the big church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, thereafter we'll call the LDS Church for convenience. Cody Brown, I think, is, or at least was, I don't know, maybe still is, the member of the Apostolic United Brethren, or AUB, the third largest denomination within the Brighamite branch of, or maybe now second largest because of the FLDS Church is a little smaller, but also then part of the grouping we sometimes call Fundamentalist Mormons, along with then the FLDS Church, or the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But then we're maybe, again, as I mentioned, less familiar with the Church of Jesus Christ, the Bickertonites. And so it's a broad constellation that exists in Mormonism, as we might want to call it, or the Latter-day Saint movement with the LDS Church. Community of Christ in the hundreds of thousands, and then other about 10 with thousands of members, of which, anyway, the Church of Jesus Christ, maybe here. And there's even emerging ones. I mean, confusingly, one of our churches from the Josephite movement, the Remnant Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, confusingly now is sharing kind of the same name with a remnant movement that has been emerging from the Brighamite tradition of the LDS Church. And then everybody's favorite is Cutlerites and Strangites. Much so. So I'm a map maker, and when I started in doing Mormon maps, there's one Mormon map, right? And so this is the Mormon map. And I always kind of say that, you know, who actually did this route? Who went from Palmyra to Kirtland to Far West to Nauvoo to Winter Quarters to Salt Lake City? Obviously not Joseph Smith. Didn't make it. Brigham Young didn't start in Palmyra. So who's the answer? Who did this?
Warren Porter Rockwell.
or in Porter Rockwell. Of course, Mike Quinn knows. So this is a map, and it only is about Rockwell. So anyway, there can be context that you add in, obviously, and you have to, let's say, look at what the contemporary, this is for 1844, obviously, you have to make a whole transitioning thing to go back to 1829, 1830. Obviously, there's a lot more complexity to where everybody came from, what was going on. The whole Missouri and Kirtland period is largely simultaneous. And then there's a bunch of different details that get left out, right? And so not everybody after Nauvoo went west. Lyman White and his folks went down to Texas, where they had a very successful, for a time, colony. The Strangites up in Wisconsin and Michigan, the Cutlerites in Iowa and Minnesota, and of course, Sidney Rigdon going back to Pennsylvania, which we'll talk about today. And so there's a whole bunch of the different branches, and there's a whole bunch of different language. Steve Shields, who I mentioned, is, I think, the leading scholar in this field, doesn't like to use the Ite groups because he thinks it's maybe demeaning, and so not everybody likes to be called an Ite. That is a contemporary name from back when 1844 happened, and I'll just use it, calling myself a Josephite, which is to say somebody from the Joseph's the Third tradition, and we'll also use it indiscriminately to say the Brighamites for all the people who might be have followed Brigham Young, so that we're not only talking about the smaller churches with those. That's how I'll do it. So essentially the Brighamites, Strangites, Josephites, Rigdonites, Hedrickites, and Cutlerites, those are the main branches that have continued to this day. So when we look at the early church period, I showed that map. So the church is evolving as all these new things are rolling forth, all these changes are happening. Those changes happen in terms of the headquarters is moving. Every time it moves, that's causing change. Every time that the headquarters moves, people are left behind. There's all kinds of people from the Kirtland High Council that are buried in Kirtland Cemetery because they did not move on to Missouri, right? And so I kind of show this with color. You can't really see it in the timeline, but essentially if it's starting in a kind of a blue New York tradition, by the time Joseph Smith dies, it's this yellow Nauvoo tradition at headquarters. Meanwhile, the bulk of the members are actually in they are tracking much earlier, so they aren't up aware of the secret things that are being taught, let's for example, in Nauvoo at the end. And so all of them, you know, are have, let's say, maybe bought into an earlier form of Mormonism and are experiencing that in their congregations. All of us are not, in general, part of the Q15 or whatever of our individual churches. Rather, we have our own individual branches or congregations or wards. And I show this sometimes, I illustrate anyway, this evolution with that 1830 organization where there's really just three priesthood offices. Is there a question?
Can we turn off the lights so we can see that better?
Please turn off the lights so we can see this better. Yeah, I'm sorry that these slides are... Thank you. That's a lot better, right? there's no different... Okay, so it's spooky. This is, so anyway, it's a lot better to see the slides now. So anyway, if we started with that, you know, when the church is organized April 6th, we have essentially just three offices, teacher, priest, elder, and of which elders are thought of as apostles and the, oh, there you go, that's nice. And then of which, you know, Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery are the first and second elders of the church. You know, you fast forward to 1833 and you still have those blue offices, but now we have, you know, all of these, you know, new green offices that have been revealed or restored. So there's a high priest, or rather, some of the elders have been ordained to a higher priesthood or a high priesthood, and it eventually coalesces into an office of high priest. We've added deacons, we've added bishops over the temporal affairs, you know, essentially a bishop in Zion, a bishop in Kirtland. And we have pastors or presiding elders of the different branches, and we have a presidency of the high priesthood. So in other words, if you had been like the Whitmers and signed up for this earlier kind of church, this blue New York style church, it's already changed a bunch by the time you get to a green Kirtland church. And then as Kirtland evolved, just 2 years later, you know, there isn't a lot more structure that a lot of us are familiar with. Some of us have inherited some of these things like presiding evangelists slash patriarchs and also evangelist patriarchs, high councils, which ultimately evolve into either the presiding high council or the standing high council or stake high councils, the traveling high council, the 12 presidents of 70s, etc., right? So I'm just showing that to show that this is an evolving movement, fairly rapidly, not only geographically changing, but structurally changing, doctrinally changing. And so if we were to go and take that 1835 organization, every one of those represents a person. You know, we can see Oliver Cowdery, or we can see Parley P. Pratt, or all the other different people that are filling those different roles. And if we take those 1835 people and fast forward to 1847, when Brigham Young reorganizes his first presidency in Council Bluffs, Iowa, the people of those originals, the darkened ones here, have all died. The ones that are in orange are the ones that are with Brigham Young. The ones that are gray have gone off and are not in the movement anymore. They're ex-Mormons. And then the ones that are in blue are members of some other tradition church that is not the Brighamite church, right? So in other words, there's not just one path that everybody went. And so obviously the main moment of schism is in the martyrdom. Hiram, who might have been the successor if Joseph hadn't died, died too. And so as a result, Mike Quinn in the Mormon hierarchy has identified all kinds of different succession alternatives. So everybody from Sidney Rigdon, who is the last surviving member of the first presidency, William Marks, who's the president of the presiding high council, Brigham Young, who's the president of the traveling high council, William Smith in a lineal priesthood, who's part of the Smith family, the last adult male member of the Smith family, Lyman White, who is a senior member, one of the people who'd been, for example, the general in the Zion's camp. In other words, somebody who had had a more senior position than Brigham Young earlier on, but now is junior to him in the 12, but is also part of this Council of 50, of which many of these are, which is organized by seniority in terms of how old you are. And so therefore, men like Lyman White and Alpheus Cutler have a senior position then to a younger man like Brigham Young. Joseph III, who's only 11, but had been designated as a successor. So in other words, that's eventually a possibility. David Whitmer, who had been out of the church for a while, but had nevertheless been designated as a successor. And then kind of out of left field, but with a pretty strong claim because of claiming angelic ordination, which he says essentially how can anybody who is in a lower office ordain somebody to a higher office. If you ran out of elders in your ward, you can't have a bunch of deacons get together and ordain a new elder. It's likewise, apostles can't possibly ordain a new prophet, which is a higher office, and so that's kind of his argument. The angels came back and ordained me the same way that they'd done Joseph Smith. So anyway, we know very well that this comes down to kind of this showdown between the one side of the faction who essentially William Marks felt that the Emma wanted William Marks to be the leader. So in other words, as the president of the presiding high council, she felt that he should be the new leader of the church. He felt no, legally. Sidney Rigdon has the best claim as the surviving member of the first presidency. Meanwhile, Brigham Young doesn't think so at all, you know, not either of those. And they kind of a showdown. He outmaneuvers Sidney Rigdon quite decisively as they each present their cases to just a congregation of people assembled in Nauvoo. Sidney Rigdon stands up and gives his case. He should be the guardian of the church. Brigham Young more or less gets up and says, how can we replace Joseph Smith? The martyr's blood is in the grave. You want to have Sidney Rigdon be the new Joseph Smith? That's not possible. We can't replace him. You no longer have a prophet in the flesh, but you have apostles who can lead the church. We should sustain the 12 as the new first presidency of the church. There's a time for a rebuttal. Sidney Rigdon picks somebody he's tired and addled and old, and so he picks somebody to speak on his behalf. That guy's been already convinced by Brigham Young, so he speaks on Brigham Young's behalf. Sidney's completely outmaneuvered, and within a couple months, he has to flee Nauvoo in exile and goes to Pennsylvania. So that's kind of just, anyway, the background. So what we have then is, if I was trying to show in color, we go from this kind of evolving blue New York church to kind of a green Missouri slash Kirtland church to kind of a yellow kind of Nauvoo church, of which there's a secret inner groups that have been meeting in the Red Brick Store with Joseph Smith. There's new practices that are kind of emerging, kind of an orange Mormonism, of which, like I say, again, the branchers are quite unaware. There is a bunch of different ways then for different groups to say, how do we recapture that experience? How do we understand the true essence of what it means to be a Latter-day Saint? do we even want to use the word Latter-day Saint? Was that a mistake when we picked that name up? When we originally were called Church of Christ, a lot of them decide that that was possibly and when we went into error. And so there's three ways then to envision a true Mormonism. You're either going to look back and you want to purify it. Where did we go wrong? Let's go back to the place where we clearly, I mean, we obviously weren't meant to end up with Joseph Smith killed. That wasn't the goal, where we're going, something went wrong and we made a bad path. Let's go back and find out and where that path was and go now from and start over. Joseph Smith, number two, preservation. Joseph Smith has fulfilled the gospel and we have it and we have to hold on to this until the end times. So we're not, we've got to preserve their fullness here. Or this church has been rolling forward all this time, innovation. We need to now have that continue on because it'll now be a prophetic successor that does that. And so each one of the different groups kind of does those different things. The Whitmerite Church, Warren Parrish's church back in Kirtland, but especially then also Sidney Rigdon's church, they decide there have been errors made. And so essentially they take that onion and they start peeling it back. We shouldn't have added polygamy, of course. We shouldn't have taken up arms. We maybe shouldn't have changed our name to the Church of the Latter-day Saints, all of these kind of things. And unfortunately, what ends up happening with Sidney is that you keep peeling it back, and as you do, you get back to that earlier kind of Mormonism. Anybody who come on later, this is like, what are you talking about? You're getting rid of something that's, you know, was what I signed up for. And so it pretty much gets back to the beginning, what Sidney was doing before the churches merged, which is to say they're all living together in common in a kind of a farm like they were doing in Kirtland before the merger of the two churches. Yeah, they end that same way in Pennsylvania, and his church atomizes. Preservation, churches like Alphaeus Cutler, Lyman White, the Cutlerites, the Whiteites, and Brigham Young. And so essentially, going here from yellow to orange, which is to say bringing those things that have been done in secret to the whole membership, so there is a little bit of an innovation there, but otherwise more or less trying to hold on to what we had at the end in Nauvoo. Innovation, so in other words, a new prophet has been called to continue to add revelations. People like Joseph Morris, like Charles Thompson, like James Strang, who has new plates, new translations, new scripture, a fourth book of scripture to add in addition to the Bible, the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants. Now we have the Book of the Law of the Lord. And so those then are the main groups that have survived to this day as the in terms of order of organization or reorganization. So the Rigdonites, the Strangites, the Brighamites, the Cutlerites, the Josephites, the Hedrickites, and then other that don't exist anymore or have died out. Anyway, of which the Strangites, they're my other favorites. I don't want to say, Bickerdites are also my favorites. The Strangites are my other, I have them in my heart. So anyway, I love to go and hang out with the Strangites who have, their congregation is back in Voree, Wisconsin, where they have a fully functioning, one thriving congregation. It's not a big tradition church at this point, but they have been completely, I would say it's completely sustainable because they've been about this size since about the 1870s or something like that. And so essentially they're still trucking along and they're a very, very, very interesting church. Brighamites, you guys are all very aware of moving forward into the different branches that have moved out in terms of the fundamentalist Mormon tradition, and now obviously new ones that need to be added. Actually, to the chart, I need to add the Remnant and other kinds of new churches that are emerging. And actually, I got to update the leader, I can't keep track of all the little churches, so I don't know who the leader is now. But anyway, it used to be Monson. Anyway, so I don't know. Anyway. Cutlerites, the Cutlerites are down to just the six or seven members. They've gathered back to Independence, Missouri. They're the ones that everybody is the most interested in because outside of the Brighamite tradition, they're the only one of the churches that has kind of maintained a Nauvoo-era endowment, which we understand that they do, although they won't tell us they do because it's sacred, not secret. But we are not, we don't know what it, they actually haven't published it on the internet and all that kind of thing, so we don't know what it is. And so I always kind of say we have a dozen scholars camped out around the Cutlerites, and there's more scholars than there are Cutlerites. And so anyway, I always go around and tell them, go and look at the Bickertonites. they're so interesting. So the Hedrickites, so you guys know them as the Templelot Church, but they have had their own amazing divergent paths where it's all the way, everything from the first Pauline Hancock, the first woman to be the leader of one of these, this church ultimately votes that it doesn't believe that Joseph Smith was a prophet, that the Book of Mormon was Revelation, and it ultimately votes itself out of existence because it goes left like that, to another one of these churches that he's essentially left the Restoration and become a white identity church. So it's polar opposites. Non-existence of the Whitmerites and the Whiteites, who have the Whitmerites died out as of the 1960s, sadly. And then, of course, in the reorganization, so bringing, one of the reasons why there's so few of the littler churches is that so many of the members joined into the reorganization, which itself then has had its own fundamentalist schism, especially over the issue of women's ordination in the 80s. So our own Fred N. Larson here is leading a church called the Remnant Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which is quite different from Denver Snuffer and the Remnant, right? It's confusing. So anyway, so that brings us to what we're talking about today, which is I mentioned a little bit about Sidney Rigdon and how his church then in essentially the Pittsburgh area atomizes, but one kind of leader who he ends up having to go move to New York with his son-in-law, and he's kind of living there for the rest of his life, and he has a little bit where he continues to create a church with Stephen Post, a former Strangite leader who he's like essentially having a correspondence church with, where he sends revelations and they go and they make a colony in Iowa and I think later in Canada, but ultimately that dies out. And then Bickerton, who is left in Pittsburgh with all of the remnants of Sidney Rigdon's church, and kind of left to his own devices. And so we're going to let Daniel talk about Bickerton.
Hi, everybody. So what I'm going to do now is, can you mind turning the lights on? Thanks. I got to read something. So anyways, just to kind of give you an update on John's awesome presentation. So why did I write this book? Well, basically, I grew up in the Bickertonite Church. I was born and raised in it. And then I realized, you know, I got into history, and now I'm finishing up my candidacy as a doctoral student. I defend in September. And I just really wanted to know more about William Bickerton, because I read the church history books and there was barely anything written about him. Here we're called the Bickertonites and we have this awesome heritage, and yet where is he mentioned in the book? And that's what made me so interested to want to write about him, because it's not often in American religion where you find a stone that has never been unturned, and that was William Bickerton. So, so that's exactly what I went into. And what I realized getting into it, I found out why he was so unknown, is because the family that eventually ended up taking over the church kind of tucked Bickerton away. So I was kind of trying to bring him out. So you might wonder, well, is this an apologetic work? Well, I can tell you right now that it is not, because William Bickerton came back from the dead, and I had to face some setbacks by it, because I was told by people of the church that's not what really happened. I'm like, oh, yes, it did. So it's the heritage history versus the actual history. And this is what I would like to say is hopefully the closest to the actual history that we have. No worries. So where does William Bickerton fit within Sidney Rigdon? And really, just to kind of give you an idea, so John gave this awesome presentation. Sidney Rigdon eventually goes back to Pittsburgh after he has this big climactic debate with Brigham Young, right? Well, he's there, and there's all these newspaper articles being written about Sidney Rigdon. The Pittsburgh Press was really interested, because Pittsburgh was basically Sidney Rigdon's home base, right? He was from Western Pennsylvania originally, that's where he grew up. And so when him and Joseph Smith are running for the presidency, he actually moves to Pittsburgh earlier on to be Joseph Smith's vice presidential running mate. And it's not necessarily a law, but it looks really good to have two political, your two people running on the same ticket to be from different states. So he goes there for that reason. He also, you know, there was a revelation from Joseph Smith that he says, sooner or later, my servant Sidney will go back to Pittsburgh. So he fulfills that prophecy. So the newspapers are really interested. They're keeping track of the debate that's happening in Nauvoo. Sidney Rigdon goes back to Pittsburgh, and he creates his Church of Christ. Like John said, he's basically trying to restore the Restoration, in a sense, try to get back more to a Kirtland-style area church. And he actually organizes the church on the 15th anniversary of the original Church of Christ, and it was in April of 1845. And there's this really interesting historical event that happens while they're conducting the conference. If you look at the history books, it's called the Great Conflagration of 1845. Pittsburgh actually almost burns to the ground. It's very, very terrible. It's like the Chicago fire. So while they're having this conference, Sidney Rigdon and them, they're praying, and they hear these shrieks and these cries from outside the windows, and they're trying to figure out what happens. Well, this is the Great Conflagration. This is the burning of Pittsburgh. So according to the Sidney Rigdon's church minutes, they say that they kneel down and pray, and then as they're praying, they say they see visions of angels escorting the building, and they put out the fire in Pittsburgh, and everybody's saved. Well, there's newspaper accounts of this. People don't necessarily like that account, and I'll read you one of the accounts that William Bickerton probably could have read in Pittsburgh at this time because he was not a member of the Latter-day Saint movement. When the story of Rigdon saving the city reached the secular press, people were repulsed. These fanatics quietly pursued their mummeries while the city was consuming, the Pittsburgh Daily Gazette and Advertiser huffed. Our citizens would have thanked them to have sent their escort of heavenly messengers a little sooner and not have waited until the fairest part of our city was laid in ashes and many lives had fallen a sacrifice to the devouring element. Rigdon's newspaper contained other strange things, the writer claimed, and promoted as many absurdities in this lightened age as ever took place in the darkest eras. So you see, Sidney Rigdon, like I said, he was big news. Well, where does William Bickerton fit within this? He is an English immigrant. He comes from England. He immigrates to America in 1831. He eventually makes his way to Pittsburgh in 1844, right as all this is happening, right as the newspapers are exploding. And he's really interested. He's a Methodist, right? And Methodism is starting to kind of become more of a traditional church. They're moving away from the charismatic gifts of, like, visions and dreams, things that had kind of heightened Methodism earlier on in the 18th century. And he hears these stories of miracles, revelations, and he's really interested in Sidney Rigdon. So he goes to a meeting in Liontown, Pennsylvania, hears Sidney Rigdon preach, and he says that he said that Sidney Rigdon was the best orator I've ever heard in classing the scriptures together. So you can see Sidney Rigdon still had the ability to be a great orator. And he was convinced after one sermon, he gets baptized, he eventually becomes an elder, then he becomes a 70, and eventually he becomes a prophet, priest, and king. As we know with the renewal of the Council of 50 Minutes, Sidney Rigdon actually erects his own Council of 50. It's called the Grand Council, and it has 70 members. And William Bickerton actually becomes a member of that, replacing William McClellan, who used to be a prominent member of the LDS Church, a former apostle, and he eventually leaves Sidney Rigdon, and that's when William Bickerton takes over. Well, why does William Bickerton eventually leave Sidney Rigdon? It's because Sidney Rigdon tries to get back to this communal lifestyle. That was always his big idea of having a communal society. So anyways, Sidney Rigdon tries to create this communal valley in the Cumberland Valley of Pennsylvania. And Sidney Rigdon had set up this school called the School of the Prophets, as we all know, again, resurrecting what Joseph Smith had originally done. William Bickerton was a member of the School of the Prophets, and there's several people in the school that are having revelations that Sidney Rigdon should not go to the communal society. We probably all know why, because it always fails. Well, so they don't feel good about this, so they stay back. And long story short, yes, Sidney Rigdon's communal society does fall away. There's that small cohort of people that stayed in Pittsburgh, one of those which was William Bickerton. They go, Sidney Rigdon's church goes bankrupt, and Sidney Rigdon basically says this quote where he basically abandons his followers, and he says, if anyone asks to know where I'm gone, tell them I've gone to hell on a thousand years mission, and he escapes to Friendship, New York. And he basically stays with his daughter and son-in-law. So this leaves William Bickerton in a predicament, right? Because he came to the Latter-day Saint movement under Sidney Rigdon, was really interested in the Book of Mormon. That's what was really converted William Bickerton, was the Book of Mormon. He really enjoyed it. But he's got some qualms, right? Because Sidney Rigdon is really upset about the 12. He got kicked out of Nauvoo, and when he got kicked out, remember, he was the one that was keeping the secret of polygamy. Joseph Smith had proposed to his daughter Nancy. We all know this story. Well, they kind of had this idea, right? Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon come to this pact where Sidney Rigdon thinks Joseph Smith has actually repented of it, and he's like, okay, well, you're not going to do it anymore, and I won't say anything. Well, now that he's kicked out, he basically is like, I'm not going to keep the secret anymore. You know, he's so he's telling in his church newspaper in Pittsburgh, the Joseph Smith started polygamy, the 12 are practicing it. William Bickerton knew about all of this, especially being such a high member of the church. Well, there's a problem with that, right? Because Sidney Rigdon goes completely awry, and William Bickerton doesn't trust Sidney Rigdon anymore, and he sees the success of the Brighamites in the West, right? The Latter-day Saint movement is really prospering in Utah. So he has this small cohort of followers around him. Eventually it becomes 9 members, and he is a poor coal miner, mind you. He's a coal miner. He's not well-educated, and yet he's kind of fostering emotionally, spiritually, his family, and also this small cohort of people that are being around him. So he writes a letter to Canesville, and he basically sees, is there anybody can come out here and we can talk? So 2 LDS missionaries come out, John Murray and David James Ross, come out and talk with Bickerton. And they know that there's some similarities and there's some differences, right? So they kind of discuss them. And the big thing that William Bickerton wants to know, obviously, is, are you practicing polygamy? And what do the LDS missionaries tell him? No, we are not, because that's the public, that's the public stance. So William Bickerton's like, okay, well, maybe I can believe this, because Sidney Rigdon was saying all this. He goes awry. There's some differences, but majorly they're kind of agreement on the same terms. They basically use the same scriptures: Bible, Book of Mormon, Book of Moses. Yes, they had the Book of Moses. Sidney Rigdon talked about it, and he mentions it in his Messenger and Advocate. So, anyways, he joins the LDS Church. He is a devout Mormon. William Bickerton is a devout Mormon elder. He becomes the presiding elder of the West Elizabeth congregation, which is just on the outskirts of Pittsburgh. They have 9 members. So basically his cohort of 9 people become the West Elizabeth branch. After 10 months, they have 27 members. So William Bickerton's busy. He triples his congregation in less than a year. And all of a sudden, in March of 1852, so we often read in the history books, that Brigham Young comes out with the public announcement of polygamy in August 1852. What we often don't hear about, and what's really interesting about the Bickertonite minutes, is you see that there were people traveling east sending word that this announcement was going to come out. And that's exactly what happens in March. William Bickerton goes to this church meeting in Allegheny City, which is now the north side of Pittsburgh, and he's told by these traveling missionaries, or maybe they're traveling missionaries, they're just somehow they're elders that know what's going on. And they're basically told, okay, there's an announcement coming out, we're prepping everybody, and polygamy is going to be a public announcement, and people are shocked. Some people are probably, more like, oh, we knew it all along, because there was a lot going on in the newspapers at that time. But William Bickerton did not think that they were practicing polygamy, and he was stunned. So he actually stands up in the meeting and basically says, well, if the approval of God were to come to me by accepting the doctrine of polygamy, I'd prefer the displeasure of God. And he just storms out. And that's his disaffiliation with the LDS Church. So he's a maverick in a sense. He's also very much an independent thinker, but like I said, you wouldn't expect this from a coal miner. And anyways, this is where he kind of is left to his own counsel. As reading this, I kind of kept thinking, why does he not go back to Methodism? Because that seems to be the main reason. I mean, why wouldn't you just go back to where you were from? But he has this belief in the Book of Mormon, and this is what's really kind of keeping him within the Latter-day Saint movement. And he has this vision, he says, of this. He said that he was really struggling what to do, and he says he has this vision. He's placed on the highest mountain on the earth, he said, and he said it was just room enough for him to stand. And basically God's telling him, and according to him in the vision, saying, listen, you're in a good place. Look where you are. You're on top of the mountain. I know it's hard, but if you this is where you need to be. Just keep going what you're doing. And if you don't, you'll tumble. And there's this big chasm below. And he says, this is where you'll fall if you don't keep on this path. So he basically says, well, what do I do? And this is where William Bickerton really becomes innovative, because he now has to start stripping away all the things that he was taught. And he's thinking, okay, well, if polygamy is wrong, polygamy is interconnected to godhood and baptism for the dead, right? These are all pillars that all reach and make people reach exaltation in the afterlife. So he says, well, if I know polygamy is wrong, and if the Book of Mormon condemns it, and he feels the Bible condemns it, then therefore polygamy, baptism for the dead, they're no longer right. And he creates this church called the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints with the no hyphen, and then he eventually shortens it to the Church of Jesus Christ. And he goes off and basically creates his own church. So to kind of give you some interesting innovations that William Bickerton does, he's very much a revivalist preacher. He believes in spiritual gifts. This is one of the big things that he really purports. He believes in speaking in tongues, prophecy, revelation, and it's not just for him. William Bickerton is considered the prophet of the movement, but their prophets and prophetesses can also be in the church. Anybody can receive revelation for the church. Obviously, they correlate it and they have meetings, and often it's very democratic. Oftentimes, even if William Bickerton gave a prophecy, the congregation would have to vote whether they believed in it or disbelieved in it. So you can see that working out sometimes. but he really believed that, so... I think one of the most fascinating things that I found while writing the book was William Bickerton's idea about the Civil War. And with the Civil War, William Bickerton thought that this was the cataclysmic destruction that was going to usher in the millennium. Who else thought that? It was Joseph Smith. He's getting this idea from Joseph Smith's Civil War prophecy. And when you read Joseph Smith's Civil War prophecy, it's really interesting, right? It's very specific. South Carolina is going to secede from the Union. Check. You know, it says that England and Great Britain and some other European countries are going to try to rise up and kind of help the United States or help the Southern Confederacy. Check. You see that happening a little bit. Native Americans are going to rise up. You see that happening in the West. It says slaves are going to rise up against their masters. Check. So William Bickerton, seeing all this, is going, holy cow, this is really happening. So he believes that the Civil War is this cataclysmic destruction, and this is when his preaching efforts go out in full earnest, and this is where you see a major growth of the Bickertonite movement really start to grasp and come up. And the Civil War is this really catalyst. Well, what happens? We know with the Civil War, yeah, it's the bloodiest war in American history. We can understand why it's cataclysmic. We have never even seen a war to this day like that, to over 600,000 deaths, 2% of the population dies, many more casualties. It's a terrible war. But what happens after the war, right? It's the war, we have Reconstruction. Reconstruction's real messy. But William Bickerton is really thinking this is going to still lead to this millennium. He really believed, like the early Mormons did, that Jesus Christ's return was imminent. So most Americans are seeing the Civil War as a post-millennialist catastrophe, basically meaning that most Christian Americans are looking at it as like, well, This is definitely God's judgment on America, but we're going to come out of this anew, and maybe we could create like a democratic Republican utopia, and then, you know, we can constantly move towards the millennium and create this great society. Well, William Bickerton, like Joseph Smith, was a premillennialist in a sense, where he basically says, no, there's going to be this great, terrible destruction, and that's going to what's usher in Jesus Christ's second coming. So William Bickerton's really an anomaly within most of American history. He's very much similar to Brigham Young and Joseph Smith. Well, the big thing about William Bickerton is he believes that the Native Americans are a lost tribe of Israel. He actually does not believe Joseph Smith was the choice seer that's talked about in the Book of Mormon. William Bickerton comes up with this really unique idea, and David Whitmer had basically the same idea, was that this choice seer would eventually rise up, and he would be a Native American prophet that would basically gather the Native Americans, gather all the other tribes of Israel from all around the world, and then they would create this new Jerusalem in America. So William Bickerton moves out west, kind of tries to create this communal society in Zion Valley. They're actually fairly successful at doing it very early on, but the church basically sabotages itself because you have people that don't want to do it, and it basically goes away. But he goes to basically St. John, Kansas, which was the edge of Indian territory in the early 1870s, and he's basically trying to continue what Joseph Smith had started in 1831, because remember, Joseph Smith moved to Missouri, and that then was the edge of Indian territory. So William Bickerton's trying to pick up where Joseph Smith left off to fulfill that mission. And William Bickerton, basically, to kind of give you the quick synopsis of the book, there's this really interesting idea. William Bickerton's really progressive, like what we're talking about with women and with men. He never bars African Americans from holding priesthood positions. He ordains women within the ministry as deaconesses. So he's very progressive-minded. He's not afraid to talk to women privately about certain things. And there's this issue because he becomes friends with this one woman named Tryphena Taylor. And according to the accounts, what ends up happening is Tryphena's on her deathbed, and everybody's around the bed kind of waiting. You know, she's basically saying goodbye to everybody. And William Bickerton feels compelled. He goes to the creek, prays, and then he comes back and basically says, do you feel that you can be healed by Jesus? And she says, yes. And he says, well, in the name of Jesus, get up. And instantaneously, she's healed. And one of her children was healed under the hands of William Bickerton. So they kind of have this relationship. Well, her husband gets really jealous and basically says that they're having an adulterous affair. And this is the official history of the church, that William Bickerton, I was always taught, well, he was an adulterer, he went away. But looking at the accounts, that's not really what happens. Actually, it really looks like it wasn't an adulterous affair at all. It just was a really close friendship, and even all the, everybody in the community actually had thought that. They actually had an ad hoc court, a communal court within the community, and then that was Bickertonites and non-Bickertonites, and they basically said, okay, there was no sexual intimacy or there was no sexual misconduct, but you did act unbecoming of somebody of your stature within the community, which basically meant in Victorian America, you're not supposed to be friends with women that are married. So, and that's what William Bickerton did. So it really bit him in the butt in the end. And it split the Bickertonite church in two for basically 22 years. So if you ever get into the history, this is why you have a Cadman group and a Bickerton group. And long story short, what ends up happening is the church comes back together after 22 years. Bickerton basically has to bite the bullet. He is no longer the prophet of the movement. He's no longer considered the leader. And he just becomes an elder. And he basically has to bite this bullet. So I'll end the quick little presentation with this, with the introduction. And the book starts off with a quote from Job 19, which was read at William Bickerton's funeral, and it was asked by him to do this. It says, "My kinsfolk have failed, and my familiar friends have forgotten me. Oh, that my words were now written. Oh, that they are printed in a book, that they are graven with an iron pen and lead in the rock forever." Job 19, 14 to 24. Prior to his death in 1905, the deposed prophet of the Church of Jesus Christ, William Bickerton, left a final message to the world when he asked Apostle Alan Wright to read the 19th chapter of Job at his funeral. There was, of course, bitterness in this request. The one-time church president had been marginalized, his reputation tarnished by men he had mentored, who had assumed the leadership and cast him aside. Bickerton had been one of the major claimants to Joseph Smith's position as president and prophet of the Latter-day Saint Church. He had led the Pennsylvania saints and those of surrounding areas by prophecy and revelation, and he had overseen a hundredfold increase in the membership from the time he had assumed responsibility. And yet, there had been a power play, and he had lost. After investing everything, temporally and spiritually, in the church, he saw nearly everything taken away, leaving him with an affinity for Job and the Bible, and the belief that, like Job, eventually someone would set the record straight or at least attempt to tell the whole story. Over a century has passed, and his achievements and trials are still rarely spoken of among the some 23,000 adherents to the church that popularly bears his name. And then the rest is in here. Thank you so much.
All right, folks, we have about 15 minutes for questions. I think maybe the best way to do this is have you come up and ask the question into the mic, and then...
Yeah. I'll stand over here.
So in the Mormon church, they have the church archives, and there's a lot... Early on, it was difficult to turn around and get restricted documents, et cetera, and access to that. Is there a similar one within your church, and what kind of struggles did you have to pull out information and source material that they didn't really want to have to come to light?
Oh, thanks. That's a good question. That's actually a sensitive question, but I'll answer it. So what ends up happening is, so since I'm a member of the church and I wanted to write a biography, I had to write like a proposal to the apostles, and I had to get special permission from the church historian, which I did end up doing. But it was under the idea that I would be given basically open access to whatever I wanted, with the idea that whatever I wrote, I would then give it to the church to say, would you like to publish it? Well, I wrote the first five chapters of the book, and I'm a professional historian, and I wrote in my objective thing, this is what I'd like to do. There was no ifs, ands, or buts. I was very specific. I want to write this a professional, objective history and be balanced. And when I did that, they approved it. I wrote the first five chapters. I gave it to the 12, and then the 12 never gave me an answer as to yes or no. I think they were... No one's ever in my movement written a history book that was objective. So I think that's, you know, with any religion, that's kind of scary. So they didn't like that. And I was basically told by the church. So I asked the church historian, I said, can I go independent with this? And he basically kind of said, yeah, you know, go ahead. So I did it. I kind of got in trouble, a little bit of trouble for that. Not too much. I just basically had to talk with them. We kind of came to the conclusion that this was just a misunderstanding. And I also got a lot of documents from this individual in New Mexico. He's got this great archive with a ton of Bickertonite stuff. He used to be a Bickertonite, but he left, and he has a lot of the original documents. Most of the original minutes are in his possession, and it's in his private archive. So I had to get special permission from him, because no one had ever... He never gave up any of this stuff to anybody. He even told me, he goes, you know you're the first person I'm giving this to, right? And I was thankful for that, because I had the original minutes. So not only did I have what was in the church archive... I had stuff from there. And I found stuff in the church archive. It's gotten a lot better. Let me say that. There's been great people that have been organized. But when I got there, it was a hot mess. Like, there was this church, I'll give you an example. There was a church revelation book that they constantly talked about in the minutes. And I'm like, would be amazing to have. It's from the early 1850s and early 1860s. I'm going, does anybody know where this is? And nobody could tell me where it was. Well, I eventually go into the church archive. I'm digging through stuff, and I find the revelation book under stacks of dusty other books. And I open it, and I'm like, oh, here it is. You know, like, and it's unbelievable. So it was stuff like, so that kind of answers your question. So it was really a lot of fun. I got to find cool things that people didn't think existed anymore. So it made kind of gave me a boost, self-esteem in that way. I don't know. But yeah.
Well, Dan, we may be the last generation of historians who actually go in and touch the paper, which is the joy of being a historian, I think. But my question is for Mr. Hamer, which is, did you cover the Brewster rights?
They didn't get a whole they didn't get a whole thing on the chart because there would be one of the extinct, you know. So I was kind of focusing on the ones that have survived. But yeah, so I didn't cover it because I was trying to kind of make it. You know, there's so many different groups, but they have wonderful groups. So I'm sorry I didn't.
No apology. But
yeah,
the Oatman family were Brewsterites.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So it was the Mojave Indians who helped exterminate the Brewster.
So I had read that many of the members of the Bickertonite Church are Italian-American, and I'm wondering what the story is about that, and how is the church currently organized?
Oh, that's a good idea. Well, thanks. Yeah, that's true. A lot of the Bickertonites now are Italian, and that's not how it started. Most of them were English and Scottish and, you know, from the UK. And believe it or not, I am Italian, even though my last name's Stone. I get it from my dad's side. He's French. But my mother's side is how my family got into the church. It's DiNardo. So we are one of the Italian invasion, basically, which happened in the 20s and 30s and during the Great Depression. And that's how the Italians basically came in. As most of the Italians were Catholic, a lot of it happened in the early 20th century and then during the Great Depression. And Italians were really interested in the church. And basically, especially in the Pittsburgh area, you have this big Italian movement there. A lot of influx of Italian Americans. So, and that's basically how the church grows. And so now, if you look at the list of the apostles, it's kind of funny. So you read the old list of the apostles, like William Bickerton, William Cadman. These are all English names. Now it's like president of the church is Paul Palmieri. Then you have Scalero. And you have, I mean, most of them are Italian. Joel Gailey, he's from English descent. Joel Gailey is a Cadman. He's a direct descendant of William Cadman. We have Jim Crudup. He's African American. So there's some diversity, but then you have the rest of them are Italian men.
On the Italian thing, we did, you know, in terms of like Lindsay's done this wonderful job of bringing people, especially from the Western tradition, the Brighamites, you know, all together in different diverse expressions. 10 years ago, we had a conference like that in Independence where we brought for the first time about, I think, 17 different expressions of the Restoration, including we had a couple of apostles that came for the first time, I think, anytime there was any kind of an ecumenical Latter-day Saint conference from the Church of Jesus Christ. And so one of the apostles is a real Italian-American with a role, I think, Italian-American accent, you know, that's kind of, to me, sounded like a New Jersey kind of Tony Soprano kind of accent. And so he's doing his address, and he's like talking about, this is the first time he's been with all of these other people from the Restoration, and he says, you know, we got to get together. We got the Book of Mormon. We're taking a lot of hits out there on the internet, and we got to, you know, it was amazing, because it was just this incredible vernacular. I loved it.
Yeah, my question has to do with how does the Church of Jesus Christ relate to the group that's still out in St. John, Kansas? And the backup to that is 8 or 9 years ago, I was just traveling across the country, and I happened to be in St. John on a Sunday, and I went to services with them. And there was a man and I think either two or three sons. And they were very nice. It was really boring. I mean, just these people just go and listen to each other talk every Sunday. But they invited me to their home afterwards for dinner and everything. Then I went out to Mr. Bickerton's grave. So I'm just wondering how that, like, is it proper to think of that group as a schism now? Or
That's a great question.
Are they still going? I don't know. Maybe they've gone out of business now.
No, that's a great question. Thanks for asking that. Yeah, so Alexander Robinson, that's actually who I originally went to to work on this project. I actually originally talked to him, and he still lives in St. John. He's kind of been the one keeping William Bickerton's name alive. Yeah, and what ends up happening is basically, yeah, you can almost consider them a schismatic movement, that they literally believe in the same exact things that the Church of Jesus Christ, the main body, does. There's really no difference at all. The only thing for them was there was an insurance thing that the church had to come out with, and they didn't want to do the insurance policy, and they felt that they didn't feel directed to do that. So they basically were told, well, listen, if you're not a part of this insurance policy, because most of them are elders, Alex was I still consider him, he's still an evangelist, and his hun was an elder. So he basically was like, well, the church officials came out to him and was like, listen, if you don't become part of this insurance policy, like, you can't be elders anymore. You can't be part of the priesthood. And they were like, we don't feel directed to do this. I don't know what it was about it, but they just didn't like it. I don't know. I never got into the specifics with them because I just needed the Bickerton information.
This makes a lot of sense, because when I was at their house for dinner after the service, here again, this Italian ethnicity came up, and
oh, yeah. That's what they told me, too. They go, those Italians. I said, yeah, I am one of those Italians. Like,
so that's very interesting.
Yeah. No, they're very nice. But, yeah, he always talks about the Italian influx. I don't know.
this one's for John Hamer. How would you compare and contrast the remnant movement coming from the Latter-day Saint Church and the kind of the breakaways from the RLDS tradition?
So the two that are both named remnant? So the remnant movement and then the remnant Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or just any of the others from the Josephite tradition?
Yeah, I mean, there's
a weird overlap between the remnant movement, the Snufferite movement, and what we call restorationist tradition, essentially conservative RLDS. So the similarity is that the leadership, I think, has not wanted to have like an organization where they've created a new presidency or something like that, but instead they're having local faith groups, so essentially create their own branches, that there's kind of a anti-leadership, and sort of anti-corporate kind of thing. And then there's been a weird, kind of very bizarre overlap in terms of the kind of the intellectual people, or at least the people that were writing books in the RLDS movement, conservative RLDS movement in the 70s, the Prices, created a book about old RLDS faith claims about Joseph Smith not being involved in polygamy, so not a historical or academic book on that, and that has had a lot of influence in the remnant, the Western remnant tradition, the Snufferites, in other words. So they've taken some of those arguments, a lot of them, not everybody, anyway, and so that has had a weird second life, in out here. So I'd say that in terms of the characterization.
Thank you.
I'd like to hear from both of you regarding this tendency for schisms in the church. I was down in Colorado City a couple of months ago with the thing they were doing with Warren Jeff's home, and the current joke was there was now an eighth prophet who decided that the rest of those, polygamous sects weren't fundamentalist enough, and now they've got another one that's claiming, divine revelation from God. And I've met a couple of friends who, on the more of the liberal spectrum, who are wanting to start their own types of congregations and parallel churches. And I guess, my study group is technically a type of schismatic group that we form to address certain needs or get back to certain fundamentals, although it's not a formal one. The question is, there's always somebody who can claim that we're not fundamentalist enough. We're not back to the fundamental teachings of the church, whatever the church was. And you just pick the year that you want to pick, and you can justify that. How do you address that? I mean, for me personally, I have lots of complaints about the church, and I could always claim that they're not doing what Joseph Smith originally said that we should be doing, and therefore I'm going to start a new church. But I'm kind of the opinion that you need to find ways to work together rather than separate. And, that's a philosophy, but evidently people feel that it's better to separate than compromise and work together. Yeah. And I'm curious to know if you could give me your viewpoints on that, what you've learned about various factions and how they see that? Are there levels of compromise that you just can't see past, and therefore I'm not going to do this anymore? If the church started practicing polygamy, I go, that's enough. That's too much for me.
Yeah.
But, right now it's like, I can't change this church on the outside, so I put up with its flaws. And I guess everybody has their division line at one point or another. And I'm curious to know what you've learned from that in studying these groups and from your own personal take on that.
I have a comment, but I'll let John... Okay, I have a comment, but I'll let John go first.
Well, I guess I would say that in general, so we look at this kind of all from the outside, and we're kind of like mapping, or we're doing things like Steve Shields has done, where he has 1,000 expressions, and he is kind of categorizing them and trying to figure out, okay, well, this ultimately becomes an expression of one, right? Because there are bunches of expressions of one. But one of the things that we have to kind of step back as historians and not be flippant and not, because the schism happens when people who are, in general, devout believers decide that they can't be in communion with one another for one reason or another. I mean, so you cited something that might be a line in the sand for you if your tradition were to say, no, we're going back to polygamy and I'm ordering, and you're getting, having that assigned, that would probably be the thing for you that would cause you to go into schism from the movement that you've emerged in. Likewise, there's, a lot of times it can be anything like distance, it could be misunderstanding. The one that occurred in the Church of Jesus Christ, they're 1,100 miles apart. So the Cadman, we talk about the Cadman group and the Bickerton group. And so essentially the one is in Kansas, the other one's in Pennsylvania. They don't have email, and it may not have had to happen. Ultimately they were able to heal it, although the healing wasn't... It ended up being kind of subordination. So in some cases, there are rifts and not. But in general, both expressions, that will emerge, out of a schism, it's because there's devoted people who, through misunderstanding or through very fervently held beliefs and distinctives that they disagree on fundamental interpretation, they have then emerged into a thing where we can't be in community with each other anymore.
Agreed. Totally agree. The one comment I would just say is that it's a human element to, when you look at religion in general, just religions are always splitting up. And within American religion, that is huge, especially in the 19th century. I mean, you have all these prophets and religious leaders coming up, and within those groups, they're constantly sprouting. So we can thank our American self-determination and our First Amendment rights to freedom of religion for that as well. It gives us that empowerment.
One question I had, in the accusations that were made in the minutes that you've looked at against Bickerton for adultery, did anyone suggest or even claim specifically that this was polygamy?
That's a great question. I didn't address that in the book. There was no accusation of that because he was so adamant against it. Because what ends up happening is, William Bickerton from the get-go was always against polygamy, and it could look like he's trying to institute that. The problem with that is you have both William Bickerton and you have Tryphena Taylor both saying that they didn't do anything, that they're just, this is a cordial thing, and her husband just got really upset. And even the community, William Cadman basically held this ad hoc court for 8 hours and had testimony and basically brought all these people against them. He acted as prosecutor, and he was the president of the 12, and that's what they came out to. Interesting story about that, to kind of even show that it really wasn't polygamy. Tryphena Taylor, so this is how scandalous and interesting it really gets. It's very interesting. So Tryphena, after all this, her name, in Victorian America, a woman's reputation is basically her lifeblood. That is very important for her. Well, her husband ran her name through the mud. So what ends up happening? Well, she ends up going, she's seen riding around town with this guy named the last name of Hadlock, turns out to be her attorney. And there's speculation and insinuations that she's having an affair now with Hadlock. And she was a member of the Bickerton's group, and they actually had to bring her into council and was like, listen, and she was a deaconess in the church, so they basically said, listen, you have to stop riding around with this guy. You're already married to James Taylor, the guy who ran his wife's name through the mud. And she basically was like, no, I'm hanging out with this guy. So they actually had to excommunicate her because of her affiliation. So if there was any, so basically what I look at, if there was really any If this was just a big cover-up for Bickerton, you know, to kind of hide the affair, it really doesn't seem to be that case. It just seems like she was just so upset with her husband, she just basically was like, peace out. So.
All right, let's give these folks another quick round of applause. Thank you so much. We are a couple minutes over, so if we can be quick about moving on to the next session so the other folks can move in, that'd be great. Thank you.